This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The Royal Society in Britain, the country's most prestigious institute of science, has issued a new series of papers on our climate prospects. The theme is 4 degrees and beyond. Official scientific circles, including some government advisors, now seem to almost admit mistakes were made, but they're saying climate scientists underestimated the sensitivity of our ecosystem. You may not yet have been told the severity of the changes to the atmosphere and the oceans that we triggered with fossil power. David Wasdell told us that years ago. I couldn't believe it then. Now I do. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you for your welcome.
Everyone was talking about 2 degrees of warming as the upper limit we could have. Now diplomats at Cancun say even that target is no longer possible. Can we survive 4 degrees and beyond?
This is a very timely question, Alex, because it's a two-edged sword. Many of the scientists and published papers over the last 3 or 4 years have been indicating that even 2 degrees is quite a dangerous level to go to. And in the papers that you've been mentioned that have just come out from the Royal Society's journal, it's being made very clear that 2 degrees is not the threshold of dangerous warming, but the boundary between dangerous warming and extremely dangerous warming. So we have to put that as part of the context of where we're going. But back to your question itself, can we survive 4? Is 2 degrees possible to achieve? The papers that you describe from the Royal Society are saying with the current sets of promises and the current outputs of greenhouse gases, the likelihood of being able to hold a temperature increase to only 2 degrees, even though that is the boundary of extremely dangerous change, is very small indeed. A conference here held in Oxford University about 15 months ago, on which these papers are based, looked at the probability of temperatures reaching 4 degrees globally, 4 degrees increase, that is, on the pre-industrial level. And that is, it's survivable in the sense that life will go on, humanity in some form would survive, but the impacts of that and the consequences of it almost don't bear thinking about. The other thing that is absolutely crucial here is that the promises made for the Copenhagen Accord do not in any sense give a foundation for achieving the 2 degrees. They don't even give us the foundation for achieving the 4 degrees. They're way off target even for that. And judging by the way Cancun is going at the moment, and we're right in the middle of it, it doesn't even look as if those promises themselves will either hold or be implemented. So we're facing a massive, massive problem at a global scale.
You've also told us that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, was not good enough. What sort of institution do we need?
It's a difficult question again. You don't know how bold Google is. The IPCC is the most extraordinarily complex and competent bringing together of science around a particular problem that the world has ever masterminded and put together. To say it's not good enough is a very difficult value judgment. I don't think I've ever actually said that. What I have pointed out is that the papers that they review in putting together their 4 yearly reports have to be in the published domain, they have to be peer-reviewed, and that means there's a delay between publishing material and it's getting into the IPCC documents of about 2 years. And then when you think that it takes 18 months for the Intergovernmental Panel to produce its report, having gone through its assembly process, so that when it comes out, it's already perhaps 3 years behind the leading edge of published material. And to get to the published material in the first place, the scientists and the researchers have done their work, assembled the data, put it into written form, had it peer-reviewed, pushed it around, come back, edited it, polished it, sent it out for peer review again, and then got it published. So by the time we see, you know, the summary for policymakers from the Intergovernmental Panel, the material it's based on can be 5 or 6 years behind the leading edge. And that's a real worry. So I don't say it's not good enough. It is an extraordinarily competent foundation of science. it just isn't moving fast enough. And I think what the Royal Society's Philosophical Transactions Special Edition, which is the one you refer to, has done, is brought that time delay down by about 4 years. So this is leading-edge stuff. It's a year old. There's a delay in getting the material together. But even that isn't right on the button. So somehow we need an institution that creates real-time, leading-edge climate science and its implications and applications right up to date. And that needs to be available for policymakers, decision-makers around the world. What that looks like, everybody's scratching their heads about, but that's what we need.
But I think that, you know, to try and come up with a group that's going to get a consensus approval by even the greatest oil exporters like Saudi Arabia, that's going to be a problem. There's been a call that the IPCC should not be have any activism to it. We need some sort of command center. We need some sort of group that's on the job full time, paying out scientists all the time, getting some action to save us. Does that relate to your idea of Apollo Gaia?
Oh, boy. Where do we start with that one, Alex? First of all, you're moving to a command center, an application center, rather than just the information center. The IPCC is an information organization. There's no way that it has any input even to policy statements, let alone to action. Secondly, the constraints on action that we're meeting in the world at the moment are phenomenal. Let me go parallel and sidestep you a little bit. If you have a massive population addicted to heroin, and then there's a major movement to deal with this as a massive social problem, you do not give power to those who produce heroin, who profit from it, who push it, the drug barons, if you like, and the mafia, who take massive economic kickback from the addiction. If you put those into positions of power to manage the detox program for the group, they will get nowhere because there are huge vested interests in maintaining the addiction. That's very similar to the situation we're in. There are major corporations, nation states, national economies, international procedures, pension funds, the whole fossil fuel industry, the electricity generating industries, the coal producers. To name just a few, we could add in, of course, aviation, transport, automobile industries, and all the investments that depend on them. All of these see that effective action to limit the use of fossil energy would be like killing the goose that lays the golden egg. And they will mobilize goose protection procedures for all they are worth, and they have done so to huge effect, to block action on climate change that would undermine the profitability of managing the addiction. So what you're raising raises the whole issue of the dynamics of action in a world that is caught going two ways. One, a sustainable planet demand that lives within the boundaries of a viable ecosystem. If you like, our life support system is under threat. We need to solve that problem. The other one, the survivability, if you like, the sustainability of the profitability of using fossil energy. And those two are at war. And that war has immobilized the United Nations procedural processes. It immobilized Copenhagen. It is at this very moment, as we speak, immobilizing Cancun. I don't think a command center can be put together with teeth to implement a control and command program at a global level.
Very good. Well, let's get back to the science then. I saw your presentation to scientists at Talberg, Sweden in 2008. David, I came away with a lot of worry and a few new understandings. To start with, you say it's a mistake to look at temperatures only as a way of judging where we stand now in global heating. Can you explain?
Yes, that's right. I said this back in 2005, in fact, in my approach that was taken up by the Club of Rome way back then. Temperature change is a consequence of climate change. The causal thing is the new heating being applied to the Earth's surface. So if you like, it's about energy. You could have a very large room with a huge kettle of ice in the middle, and you can start pouring energy into the room, heat into the room. But the room temperature doesn't change very much with the initial heating. It takes a lot of energy to melt the ice and do other things, and then the temperature begins to respond. The Earth's even more massive and inert than that. So what we're looking at is the amount of energy per square meter that we're taking up at the Earth's surface because of the greenhouse effect, the fact that we're blocking energy going back out into space and therefore trapping more of the sun's energy close to the surface. That amount of energy is changing things in the Earth. It's melting ice. It's changing ocean currents. It's changing all sorts of processes in the climate, one of which is temperature. Now, we can monitor temperature, and we've been doing that, and we can see it going up quite fast, and then going down a bit, and then going level for a bit, and then going up again, and then down again. The overall trend is upwards, but there's a lot of variability in it. And over the last 4, 5, 8 years, I suppose, the rate of change of temperature has been fairly low, because a lot of the energy has been going on into ice melt. We've seen a lot of change in the ice fields in the Arctic and the Antarctic. It's gone into evaporation. There's a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere. It's more moist and humid. And the energy has also gone down in terms of heating the deep ocean, which is where a lot of the energy goes. So global heating continues unabated. The temperature goes through sort of wiggles. And if your temperature at the moment is anything like the anomaly that's happening here in Western Europe, and I think I'm right in saying you've got a very cold spell coming down the western coast of Canada and into the western coast of the US at the moment, people are saying, global warming, you have to be joking. But in fact, the other side of the world, the sea temperatures around Manila and the Philippines are about 10 degrees above what they should be, as are the sea temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico. And you get these shifts in local conditions, which you cannot use really to generalize about climate change. But the temperature profile, I feel like a secondary sign, a signal among many of what's going on in the energy equations of planet Earth. I hope that's not too technical.
Not at all. I really understand that. As I take it, the first burst of heating, let's say, gets soaked up into these various sinks and processes, whether it's melting ice or warming the oceans. That could take a while, but eventually when those break, then we may see a lot of more heating on the land. Did I get that right?
Well, we are already seeing some heating on the land that is quite detectable. And in certain areas, because a lot of the heat energy gets pushed towards the poles, for instance, the temperature over Greenland and around that area was about 4 or 5 degrees above what it is expected to be this last year. We had heat anomalies over northern Canada and into Alaska. We had heat anomalies over northern Russia and Siberia. And so the big land masses are showing heating of 3, 4 degrees in their polar areas, even though the average temperature increase for the Earth as a whole is only 0.8 of a degree. The critical thing to focus on is that the energy going into heating the Earth and changing the climate is inexorably going on, whatever the temperature is doing at the moment. So don't let people tell you temperature change is slowing down. There's no problem left. The problem is going on, whatever the temperature is doing.
Let's move to a second fundamental point that you make clear. There are a number of forces called positive feedbacks which multiply the impact of our human-made greenhouse gas emissions. Can you tell us how this works and why it matters so much? And please, take as long as you like.
How long is as long as I like? It's a huge subject. When I started work on this just over 5 years ago, we recognized that the effect of what we call feedbacks was, if you like, the greatest known unknown that we were struggling with. And the impact of that determined really what was going to be faced as the crisis for the future decades. My background is in what we call systems analysis, not necessarily in climate change, but we shifted application to this area and began looking at feedback processes. I think most of you who are listening to this will have been in a public hall or situation where the PA system's been turned up too sensitive and, you know, it's gone into that scream and you go, you put your hands over your ears, oh no, and where's the technician? Go and turn that thing down a bit. That's feedback. Where the signal that comes out of the loudspeakers, the output stuff, gets picked up on the inputs, i.e. the microphones, and fed back through the amplifier and out through the loudspeakers and in through the microphone and out through the amplifier and builds up until it reaches a feedback threshold and very uncomfortable. Well, the climate system is like that, except that there's about 40 identified feedback mechanisms in global climate. what we have done is put out a signal, if you like, that's our greenhouse gases and the heating that stems from that. That begins to change things at a planetary level. Temperature starts to rise a little bit. As the temperature goes up, the water vapor in the atmosphere increases. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. That increases the greenhouse effect, which changes the rate of heating, which pushes the temperature up more, which evaporates more water, which increases the greenhouse effect. You've got the idea? And there are many such feedback mechanisms that I could go into. For instance, we know now quite well that the amount of sea ice in the Arctic area is decreasing in summer, year by year. It went down to an extraordinary low in 2007. 2010 was just about the same record level. And on a trend pattern over decades, it is decreasing quite rapidly. Now, that's an effect of heating. But what it does, it decreases the amount of white surface in that area of the world during the summer period. So we have dark, open water, which absorbs sunlight and sun's energy and heat and warms up. And that increases, therefore, the absorption of energy in the Earth system. It decreases the reflectivity of the planet. And that means that the amount of heating goes up, which of course melts more ice, which means there's more open water, so the heating goes up. And that's another, what we call an albedo positive feedback. Have a look at the Teilberg presentation, which I think you're giving a link to on your website as a result of this interview.
Yes,
because
indeed.
Because I do go into quite a lot of detail about feedbacks in that.
Well, one thing I got from that was that these feedbacks may well pile up on each other so that if we think, well, we'll just double our fossil emissions into the atmosphere, we may in fact find that natural reaction to that could multiply it not by a factor of two, but by a factor of four or more. Is that correct?
Yes, and we get into areas of huge uncertainty, but about the precise quantities, because we've never been there before. But the process is pretty clear. Let me give you another for instance then. One of the issues that we look at is that the great tropical forests like the Amazon rainforest, at some stage in this development of higher temperatures and drying out of that area, begins to break down and change from tropical forest into savanna. Now that's a difficult process. That's tree death, it's burn, it's forest fires going out of control across vast areas. That's a huge, huge release of carbon dioxide from the burning and the degrade of a huge forest area. And that adds to our human emissions from the use of fossil energy and increases the rate of global heating. The same, I think, you're experiencing in Canada with the spread of the bark beetle through the coniferous forests moving up towards the tundra. And as the temperature warms, the larvae of the bark beetle are not dying out over winter. And that is racing through your coniferous forests like the plague. And those trees then start to die back. There is burn back. There is decay. And we get the northern forests going through a carbon output as well. That adds into the problem. Now, you may want to ask me more about the tundra release and what we call the methane release. Would that be interesting?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with David Wastel, director of the Meridian Program in England. His lecture series, Beyond the Tipping Point, has rippled already through the expert world. Now it's going mainstream. We should talk, I think, about the methane briefly, and then I'd like to get on to your idea of tipping points.
Okay, let's try and take this briefly. In the far north of the major continents, that's northern Canada and Alaska, and in northern Russia into Siberia, there are vast areas of frozen land, the tundra with permafrost. And as the temperature goes up and the heating to the Earth focuses, much of that energy is transported to these areas faster than at any other place in the world. And that means that these areas of permafrost are beginning to melt in the summer and melt further each summer. And one of the consequences of that is that microbial activity begins to rot the frozen vegetation that's been held in the cold store, and that starts to release carbon dioxide. And another byproduct of that is methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And there are deposits of methane held deeply frozen in the tundra, which begin to be released. We're seeing that happening already. There are lakes developing on the surface of the tundra, with methane bubbling up, and you can actually catch it and set fire to it. There's about three times as much carbon stored in the tundra deposits as we have already put up from burning fossil fuel. So as that goes, there's a huge cauldron or deposit, potentially, of further carbon dioxide and methane, which could be released into the atmosphere and is already starting to do so. And then the really big one is that under some of the shallow seas, there are vast deposits of methane in a frozen crystal lattice form, which we call clathrates or methane hydrates. And they're held in place under the temperature of the ocean depth and the pressure of the ocean depth and the temperature at which they are. And they're protected as well with ice over that surface of the ocean in many places. Now, the ice melts, the water warms, there is warmer runoff from the northern coastlines of the continental areas. The sea starts to warm, the sea mixes down to the bed, and it starts to release methane bubbling up from the seabed. It starts to break through the fossil ice that has stayed there since the last ice age, that is trapping fossil deposits of methane even deeper in, and those are beginning to come up through the rotting and permeable frozen layers of the ocean bed. And scientists are watching this very carefully because that is a feedback, because the methane is released into the atmosphere, that increases the greenhouse effect, that increases the temperature, that increases the heating, that mixes down to the ocean floor, that sets off more methane, that releases. You get the idea? And that is potentially the biggest but long-term feedback that can push the temperature almost out of control. Very worrying.
Yes.
But you were talking about tipping points.
Yes, well, you know, James Hansen has said there's many tipping points, but you have said there may be a kind of master tipping point, a point that if we cross it, the result will be catastrophic climate change. What do you mean by that?
I'm glad you raised that question because there's quite a lot of misunderstanding about tipping points. Let me give you one or two quick examples. I've already mentioned the tipping point in the Amazon rainforest between an established forested area and tipping across into the development of a savanna area with a huge shift. That's a threshold point at which, as the temperature globally reaches a certain level, a particular factor like the sustainability of the tropical forest shifts into a new behavior. And once you've passed that threshold, there's pretty well nothing you can do to stop that shift happening. It can be quite dramatic and fast. Another one would be the melting of the Greenland ice cap. Now, we're already seeing significant ice loss of about 300 cubic kilometers per annum net release of ice from Greenland. And I've got a feeling I may have got a zero wrong there. It could be more than that. But let's just take it on the principle. As the temperature increases, we reach a point where the Greenland ice cap itself begins to be non-sustainable. It starts surface melt. Water goes down to the base of the ice. That lubricates it. It starts to move down to the glacier valleys. It discharges to the sea. It melts in the ocean. And once that process starts, it feeds on itself because there is then more fresh water in the ocean. There is greater feedback around the edges of that ice cap. The level of ice starts to go down. The further it goes down, the warmer it gets because it's warmer at lower altitudes. So it melts faster. And you move into this new zone of not just a sustainable ice cap, but a collapsing ice cap. That's a tipping point. And John Schellenhuber and Jim Hansen's been involved, and Tim Lenton and many other scientists have pinned about 9 of these critical tipping points. Like the Gulf Stream that brings so much energy across the Atlantic to Western Europe, if that starts to falter, and there are conditions that make it do so, that would be a tipping point because Northern Europe will then become much colder, but the Gulf area will become much hotter. And remember, that's where all the tropical storms and the hurricanes get their energy from and lash into the east coast of the States. Those are what I call subsystem tipping points. They're thresholds at which particular phenomena change from one state to another. Now, if you look at the Earth as a whole, it looks very clear now that there is a critical threshold, a tipping point, if you will, between a state of the Earth in response to climate change that just goes up fairly slowly and reaches a new, hotter level, an equilibrium, as they call it. And the threshold is between behavior that reaches an equilibrium, it may be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees hotter than it is now, and that's catastrophic. But if this threshold is crossed, then it moves not to a new equilibrium, but to a self-amplifying runaway behavior. And where that stops at the moment is anybody's guess. But it is a whole new ballgame of looking at the future climate. In my Tailberg lecture, I specify the criteria for that. I look at the implications of it. And I make some assertions about what I saw then as the fact that we had crossed that threshold and had already started on the pathway of runaway behavior. And I'm very thankful that there was a mistake in that analysis, and we found it and put it right. The threshold was not as close as we thought it was, and we probably have not yet crossed it. But it's there as a threat in the future, and the processes that we have already put in motion make it look to me as if we are in a fairly severe risk of triggering the runaway behavior in the Earth system and crossing that total global tipping point. We don't want to go there. We have to be able to intervene early enough to make certain that that does not happen.
Perhaps that's a good point for me to ask about the possibility of any happy ending. I don't see a good outcome for our big surge in fossil fuels, but you did offer one last vision of hope. Can you share that with us?
You know, people always look for hope when faced by something that feels impossible to cope with, don't they? Whether it's illness or whatever it is. And I think there's realistic hope and there's illusory hope. And there's despair. Despair can be realistic despair. Despair can also be illusory. What I don't see at the moment is any hope at all of the global political and economic and intergovernmental negotiating process achieving an action intervention that can solve the problem in the time frame required with any realistic outcome of a survivable planet for humanity as we know it. And I have to live with that reality. I don't think it's despair. I don't think it's gloom and doom. I think it is the reality we face. Secondly, the sensitivity of the Earth system, how it amplifies the signal we have put in, the CO2 we've emitted, has been grossly underestimated in current science. That underestimate underlies all the targets being set in Cancun or not being set in Cancun. It looks as though there's an error of about 2.5 times the effect of the dynamics of climate change. It's far worse than we thought it was going to be. I think that's reality, and that, again, is not to be despaired at, but it creates a sense of eco-shock that is profound. Now, hope. The end of my Tailberg presentation, I used the image of the shift from a supertanker to a shoal. And do you remember that? You saw that presentation, I think.
I do. And for listeners, by a shoal, you're talking about like a shoal of fish, for example.
A shoal of fish, that's right.
Yeah.
And it's so dynamic and it moves almost incredibly synchronously through the water, particularly when it's under threat. But if you think Copenhagen and the economic processes, the political processes, are like some massive supertanker that is hugely inert, controlled by a tiny power elite, fueled, if you like, by fossil energy and the profits from it, and is going absolutely in the opposite direction with enormous inertia and power. But those institutions are put there by human beings, little decisions from millions and millions of people over time. We construct the supertanker. And I think the time is coming to deconstruct the supertanker, for each and every one of us to take personal responsibility, institutional responsibility, whatever our area of responsibility is. It may be individual, it's a home, it's a local community, it's a small organization, and we can work together in such a way that we take on board the reality of the crisis and develop what we call a phase change in human behavior that shifts from the command and control failures to a living, learning, moving system of humanity responding in a crisis in short timescales and at a level that actually makes a huge difference. That, I think, is a sign of hope in the social process. And I think we need to be paying much, much more attention to that as a way forward as we face the despair of the criticality of the reality we face and the failure of our political institutions to deal with it.
So there may still be the possibility of a mass shift among the people rather than in their upper institutions. We could still hope that, like those fish or the birds that you see in the sky that suddenly know it's time to, turn one way and head another, that could still happen for us here on Earth.
I think that's probably the only realistic hope we face, Alex.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up?
Yeah, I think I could bring you a story. I like stories. Do you remember the Apollo space program?
Yes.
I'm sure you do, and Apollo 11 and the landing on the moon. I think half the world was glued to the television when that first small step for humanity was taken. Big one for humankind. That was Apollo 11. Do you remember Apollo 13, two launches later?
Vaguely.
Okay, and Tom Hanks did a reconstructed movie on this one, which other people will have seen. Apollo 13 was launched and went off very smoothly, running by the book, and then there was this catastrophic explosion in one of the oxygen tanks, and it blew off half of the coating of the module and so on. And we had that laconic comment, you know, Houston, we have a problem. And the Houston Command Center went into, oh, I don't think that's possible. It must be a computer glitch. And for 15 minutes, they treated it as nothing in space had happened. They were just trying to solve the computer problems back up. And then all the signals began to come in from the monitors to say, actually, we've just pretty well lost the propulsion systems, the life support systems on this module. It really is a catastrophe. Well, we've taken 15 years to not recognize that planet Earth, we have a problem. We've blown a hole in our life support system. And I think what happened on Apollo 13, if you like, is a parable for our time. They had to abort the mission, the achievements, the goals, the wishes, the hopes, if you like, of going around the moon and doing another moon landing and all that. And they shifted the mission, like that switch in the path of a crowd of birds or a swarm of bees or a shoal of fish. And they started to move in a different direction. Survival was the agenda. Close down power systems. Find ways of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere of the module. Find ways of supporting each other with the food and the water that they needed for the long return journey. Keep each other alive if they possibly could, so they didn't lose anybody on the way back. Not knowing whether there was damage to the heat shield and whether they could in fact achieve a re-entry, even if they got it right. Loss of correction and computer systems, having to do a manual course direction just before re-entry. And they made it. Now, I think Apollo 13 is a parable for the planet. It's no longer a tiny module out in space. We are the module. Planet Earth, we have a problem. There's no Houston. There's no rescue. We are also Houston. So maybe humanity, in the spirit of response to a collective crisis, can mobilize a collective response that puts survival, not exploitation of each other, to protect our own personal interests or national interests or group interests and let the weak go to the wall, but a collective survival movement that solves the problem in the time frame we have. I offer you Apollo 13 as a parable for tomorrow's world.
And there you have it. He has presented the awful facts and fears of climate science to major conferences across the world. David Wastel is the international coordinator of the Meridian Program and director of the Apollo Gaia Project. You can find out more about that at apollo-gaia.org. All the links you might need for this are in my Radio EcoShock show blog for this week at ecoshock.info, including a recording of that Thalberg speech. Listen and learn, please. David, it has been an honor to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure.
Time has been wasted, so much precious time. All this frustration eating away at your sanity, yeah. Your path.